introduction, Matt, and thanks to Jess and Matt for inviting me, and thank you all for coming today. I should begin by telling you all that I moved from physics into philosophy, so I'm a philosopher of physics. This talk will really be a kind of attempt to take stock and to clarify certain relations between different aspects of the literature on quantum classical relations, and to make explicit a certain story about how to model classical behavior in quantum mechanics that one finds in the decoherence literature, but certain features of which have really not been stated explicitly. Really, my primary goal here is one of clarification, but also on a few finer points, right, one of really highlighting certain relatively small results that help to clarify links between different aspects of the literature. Okay, so just a brief kind of survey of the landscape on quantum classical relations, right? So the literature on quantum classical relations is vast, right? And it's not clear how these different portions of the literature relate to each other all the time. So there's literature on quantum measurement, environmental decoherence, decoherent histories, quantum unravelings, Ehrenfest theorem, right, the correspondence between Poisson brackets and commutators, right, the result that gives us the quantum Hamilton-Jacobi equation from Schrodinger's equation, right, path integral formalism, right, tells us that only classical paths contribute to the path integral as h bar goes to zero. So in the Wigner function formalism, we see that the Moyal bracket approaches the Poisson bracket as h bar goes to zero. Right, and WKB approximation, something called Maslow's recipe, which we'll talk about in a bit, and the limit as n goes to infinity is the number of energy or the energy level in an atom, right, and various quantization methods. Right, so this is a really broad literature, and the links between these various aspects of the literature are often will remain obscure. And as Lanzmann's written, right, none of these ideas in isolation is capable of explaining the classical world, but there's some hope that by combining all three of them, one might do so in the future. Right, so there's a lot of work to be done in the synthesis and distillation of these results. As a philosopher of physics, right, I see it as a potential project or a useful project for a philosopher of physics, really to give that sort of breadth of perspective and to attempt to tie together certain more specialized aspects of the literature. So in particular, what I'm going to do today, right, so the goals of this talk are first to highlight a distinction between what I call formal and empirical approaches to quantum classical relations, which I think helps to clarify the significance of some of these results. A second is to argue that problems afflicting what I call the formal approaches to quantum classical reduction, right, don't pose a problem for empirical approaches. And then finally, I outline an empirical account of quantum classical reduction offered by decoherence theory. And the goal here is really to synthesize and state more explicitly the picture of classical behavior that's implicitly understood by many experts on decoherence, but less clearly, or much less clearly, grasped by those outside the field. Okay, so the outline of the talk will be as follows. So I'll first begin by introducing the formal empirical distinction, right, then discuss in this following section, right, a particular formal approach to the reduction of quantum, of classical to quantum mechanics. Third, discuss an empirical approach based on decoherence, and finally, wrap up. Okay, so the literature on quantum classical relations can be divided, really, or one might attempt to divide the literature on quantum classical relations into two broad categories. Right, first, formal analyses, which are focused primarily on the relations between the mathematical formalisms of the two theories, and empirical approaches, which are focused primarily on the relationship between quantum and classical behavior. Right, and so there's more of an emphasis on the systems themselves rather than simply on the mathematical formalism. Now, I don't mean to suggest that these two types of analysis, right, are mutually exclusive, often they're overlapping, but as we'll see, this distinction will become useful in really drawing out the significance of some of the results listed in the first slide. Okay, so here, right, so reduction is often a word that's often a source of frustration because everybody means something different by it. So I'll just begin by clarifying that what I mean by reduction here, right, is essentially the requirement that one theory encompass the domain of successful applications of the other. Right, so it's not fundamentally the requirement that one theory be a limit of another in any case, or in any sense. Right, it's really fundamentally the requirement, right, that all the behaviors that can be, right, accurately modeled, right, on one theory can be modeled at least as accurately, right, on another theory. Okay, and so just as there are, kind of broadly speaking, right, formal and empirical approaches to quantum classical relations, generally, more narrowly, there, right, one can distinguish between formal and empirical approaches to quantum classical reduction. Okay. Now, formal approaches to quantum classical reduction treat reduction as an a priori relation. That is, given the mathematical frameworks of the theories, right, one can assess whether one theory encompasses the domain of all successful applications of the other. That is, right, once you're given, right, the mathematical models, the mathematical formalism, right, it's a purely mathematical question from that point on, right, whether one theory encompasses the domain of successful applications of the other. Right. Empirical approaches, on the other hand, right, treat reduction not as an a priori relation, but as an a posteriori relation. Right. That is, right, they focus on how to model specific behavior. So reduction is not solely a question of mathematics. That is, given the mathematical frameworks of the reduced and the reducing theories, one still can't determine, or that's not generally enough information to assess whether one theory encompasses the domain of the other. That is, there's a further empirical input that's required beyond just a mathematical analysis of the relations between the theories. And I'll say more about the sense in which, right, the empirical reduction is an a posteriori relation. But really the idea here is to treat reduction, right, as a relation not only between the abstract mathematical frameworks of the theories, but also between the theories and the physical system that they're describing, or set of systems. Okay, so formal approaches specifically to quantum classical reduction are, for example, exemplified by work on H bar goes to zero limits, and empirical approaches are really exemplified by work on decoherence measurement and certain forms of Ehrenfest theorem. And I should just say something about the convention that I use when I'm going to employ when I use the term reduction. So very often, right, in physics textbooks, you'll find that the more general or the more encompassing theory is said to reduce the less general or less encompassing theory. So for example, special relativity reduces to Newtonian mechanics. Right? The philosopher's convention, on the other hand, is just the inverse of that. So really it takes the less general theory to reduce to the more general theory. Okay. So in the same sense that, say, right, mathematics is supposed to reduce to logic or set theory. Right. So it's really, right, so the philosopher's convention is really takes reduction to be the subsumption of the reduced into the reducing theory. So I'm going to, with apologies, use the philosopher's convention here just because it's the one that I use in the paper associated with this. But if you're not comfortable with that, I'd ask you just to perform the necessary inversion. Okay, so I've defined reduction, at least as I'm using the term here, as just the subsumption of the successful applications of one theory by another. Right? So it's all phenomena that, say, obey the laws of classical mechanics also obey even more precisely the laws of quantum mechanics. So every classical system is also a quantum system in this case. So given only the mathematical frameworks of the two theories, for example, quantum and classical mechanics, I claim, it's not generally possible to determine whether all behaviors that are well modeled in the purportedly reduced theory are also well modeled in the purportedly reducing theory. That is, given only, right, a mathematical specification of the models, right, it's not possible to determine whether, right, all behaviors in the domain of classical mechanics, right, can be subsumed into the domain of quantum mechanics. Right, so there's a certain further empirical input concerning the reduced models domain, so in this case the classical models domain of approximate validity, right, that's required in order to assess whether reduction occurs. Okay. right? Because ultimately, right, reduction only requires quantum mechanics to recover the successes of classical mechanics, right, in those cases where classical mechanics is successful, right? And the extent, right, of the dovetailing that's required between quantum and classical models, right, is going to depend on the empirical fact about where classical mechanics is successful and about where it's not, right? So ultimately, I claim, right, so empirical reduction is still a mathematical relationship, right, but it's one that's parameterized by certain empirically determined values, right, that characterize the extent and how fine-grained the dovetailing between the models needs to be. Okay. So I think that, you know, within the context of formal approaches to reduction, right, there's a hope that that just through mathematical analysis, right, one's going to show, right, that one theory is somehow a special case of another. Right. And that, right, and then just by through this sort of special case relationship or this limiting case relationship, it's going to follow necessarily that any instance of classical behavior is also an instance of quantum behavior. But I think that that's really not borne out by, you know, a detailed technical analysis of the theories. That really, what you have only ever is approximate correspondence, and the measure of that approximation, the precision, and the timescales over which that approximation holds or needs to hold in order to have domain subsumption, right, again, is an empirical fact. It requires empirical input beyond the specification of the models themselves or the theories. Right. So we'll see that reduction on an empirical approach, right, is mediated, right, by a mathematical relationship between the models, but it's an empirically constrained mathematical relationship. Okay. So my claim here is that really formal approaches, right, which is to treat reduction solely as a question of mathematics without requiring any further empirical input, really take their eye off of the real physical systems that we would hope to model quantum mechanically. Right? So the real physical systems in the domain of classical mechanics that we would hope to model quantum mechanically. Okay, so I'm going to just give an example or a couple of examples of what I mean by a formal approach to reduction in the context of quantum classical relations. All right, so I'll just begin with the kind of something you tend to read in textbooks, right? So an example of the relationship or what's of the account of quantum classical relations that's often given, say in a graduate quantum mechanics textbook, right? So this is just one example among many, but if you plug the polar decomposition of the wave function into Schrodinger's equation, right, and then look at the real and imaginary parts of that equation, right, one of those will give you, right, the essentially what looks like the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, right? So where S is the phase of the wave function and R is the magnitude, right? But there's an extra term, right, sometimes called the quantum potential, right, which, right, deviates from the usual Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Okay, so the claim that's made is that h bar goes to zero, we recover the usual Hamilton-Jacobi equation, right? And, right, so as Sakurai, for example, writes, right, not surprisingly, in the h bar goes to zero limit, classical mechanics is contained in Schrodinger's wave mechanics, right? And so statements like that could easily leave, right, a student with the impression that, okay, we understand the relationship now, we're done, right? All settled and good, right? And clearly, a result like this, insofar as it plays a role, right, in explaining real classical behavior quantum mechanically, right, is only a small part of such a story. Right, so for example, right, so there's the oft-made criticism of what do we mean by h bar goes to zero given that h bar is a constant. Right, we'll get into that a bit in a second. But also, right, a concern about this sort of account of quantum classical relations is that, right, so if we require, so say we keep h bar constant, we require this to go to zero, right? Well, one of the things that solves that is a plane wave, and there could be nothing less classical than a plane wave, because position is completely indeterminate there. So this attitude towards, so this formal attitude towards reduction is neatly captured, right, in a quote by Michael Berry. Right, so he writes, to begin, realize that theories in physics are mathematical. They are formal systems embodied in equations. Therefore, we can expect questions of reduction to be questions of mathematics. How are the equations or solutions of equations of one theory related to those of another? All right, and this is the important part. The less general theory must appear as a particular case of the encompassing one, as some dimensionless parameter, call it delta, takes a particular limiting value. A general way of writing the scheme is encompassing theory goes to less general theory as delta goes to zero. Right, so you're right. So thus reduction must involve the study of limits, that is asymptotics. The crucial question will be, what is the nature of the limit delta goes to zero? Right. We shall see that very often reduction is obstructed by the fact that the limit is highly singular. Right, so he's claiming that reduction fails in the case where these limits are singular. Right. And that reduction generally is just a matter of taking the limit as some dimensionless constant goes to zero. Right, so this really strongly suggests a formal approach. And in other parts of his writing, right, he says that it's really just about the mathematical relationship between the theories. Right, but he improves somewhat on the usual sort of h bar goes to zero theme, right, by requiring that the relevant parameter, right, be dimensionless. So really what we mean by h bar goes to zero is h bar over some, right, dimension of action associated with the system goes to zero. So h bar goes to zero really means we keep h bar fixed and we take some comparable measure of classical action to infinity. All right, and that's something that can be varied across systems. Okay. So this is, you know, a common way of sort of getting out of the usual critique that h bar doesn't go to zero for real physical systems. But it's often the case, and in particular it's the case in Berry's work, right, that it's never clearly specified, right, what the specific measure of classical action ought to be in many cases. Right? And the results derived by expanding in h bar, right, are rarely ever reformulated by expansions in this dimensionless parameter. Right? So it's more of a promissory note that one can reperform these sorts of analyses in terms of expansions in h bar, in terms of expansions in this dimensionless parameter. Right? But even if one, right, accepts that this sort of dimensionless line works, right, it doesn't explain why, if we take reduction, right, from the outset simply to be domain subsumption, just the requirement that any behavior accurately modeled in one theory can be accurately modeled in another, right, it doesn't explain why reduction, in that sense, always must be a matter of taking some limit. Right. It's simply presupposed, right, almost as a matter of habit, right, and on the basis of certain very clean-cut examples, like the relationship between Newtonian mechanics and special relativity, that reduction is always a matter of taking some limit. And really what I want to question here is that assumption, right, that domain subsumption is always a matter of simply taking a limit as some parameter goes to zero. Okay. Right. And in particular, right, in the context of quantum classical relations, right, the claim that singular h bar goes to zero limits block the reduction of classical to quantum mechanics. Right, so a simple example that Berry gives. Right, and so let's take a double slit experiment. Right, so just a quantum double slit experiment. The probability, right, of an electron, say, ending up along the back wall, right, is just given by this expression where this is the position along the back wall and this is the momentum of the incoming electron. Now he notes that as h bar goes to zero, right, this function is singular. Right? So here's an example of a singularity as h bar goes to zero. Right? And so rather than giving the classically expected result, right, we have a singularity, right, as h bar goes to zero. So it's this sort of result that's supposed to entail that reduction of classical to quantum mechanics fails. Right? So there's a more complex example, which is treated both in Berry's work and in the work of Robert Baderman, which, right, is based on a certain prescription for constructing quantum mechanical wave functions from classical Lagrangian surfaces. So for our purposes, right, let's just take a narrow understanding of Lagrangian surface and just consider it to be the set of all points, right, Q and then del sub Q S of QP, right, where S is the generating function of some canonical transformation, right, and we leave P constant. Right? So if we have n degrees of freedom, right, then this will be an n-dimensional surface over configuration space. Okay. For fixed P, or for fixed big P. Okay. Now, the recipe is to construct a wave function, right, from that classical Lagrangian surface, right? So, right, so essentially, right, it's not, I'm not going to go into the details because the details aren't really necessary to my point, but we can talk about them afterwards if you like. But we can, right, so on the basis of, right, so given a Lagrangian surface, we can construct a wave function out of it, right? Where the phase is essentially, right, just the generating function. So one point, another singularity that's often noted, right, is that the exponential is singular as h bar goes to zero, right? So the complex exponential oscillates infinitely rapidly as you take h bar goes to zero.
Sorry, what's capital Q?
So we have a canonical transformation from small q and small p to big Q and big P, right? And so this is the generating function of that canonical transformation, right? And then essentially what we do is, this construction assumes a kind of uniform density for constant P over the big Qs over a surface given, well, over a surface with constant P, right? And then essentially project down onto the little Qs.
I should think of it as a vector whose components are the q sub j's. Is that the
yeah, so these are the these. So these go from 1 to n, right? So these are the configurations for the initial canonical coordinates. These are the configurations for the new canonical coordinates, right? And then this is the generating function of a transformation from these to these. Yeah. Right, and then this is just, I mean, so you can basically q, big Q is just equal to partial s, a partial big P. And so you can just plug that into this relationship. Okay. So, right, so the Hamiltonian evolution of points in phase space is going to induce an evolution on this Lagrangian surface, right? And so, right, from the Lagrangian surface, we can construct a wave function. And so the Hamiltonian evolution of points in phase spaces induces an evolution on this wave function that's constructed from this Lagrangian surface. All right. And if the Lagrangian surface becomes multivalued, as it typically will, particularly in chaotic systems, the wave function will be defined to have multiple components. Right. So there's a way of just joining the kind of each single valued component of this kind of multivalued Lagrangian surface. Now, for chaotic systems, right, what Berry and Baderman point out is that these limits, h bar goes to zero, t to infinity, right, don't commute. Right. So the classical and Schrodinger evolutions for this wave function, right, don't give the same state, and reduction is said to fail.
Where does the t goes to infinity limit come in?
So that's basically for chaos, when you consider chaotic systems, yeah. Right, you want to recover classically chaotic behavior from this construction. Essentially, right, what you can do is apply the Schrodinger evolution to an initial wave function, right, or you can apply the evolution that's prescribed by the Hamiltonian evolution on this Lagrangian surface through this kind of Maslov construction. Right. And you can look at the semi-classical sort of WKB limit of the Schrodinger evolution, right? And whether you take, right, so their claim is if you take the limit h bar goes to zero, or if you take some sort of WKB approximation, and then the limit t goes to infinity, that doesn't give you the same thing as if you first take the limit t goes to infinity and then some WKB approximation.
But why do I want to take t goes to infinity at all? If I'm just trying to show a correspondence between classical and quantum mechanics, why don't I just take h bar goes to zero to finite t?
Right, because their claim is that you want to recover classically chaotic behavior, right? So this correspondence works for short times,
okay.
But in order to recover classically chaotic behavior, right? So chaos is often characterized in terms of an infinite time limit, right? And in order to recover, right, the full range of classical behaviors, you're going to want to take both t to infinity and h bar goes to zero. So I'm sorry, I'm kind of, you know, being fairly superficial about this. It's just that, you know, I don't want to get bogged down in the details, because the points that I, you know, or the critique or the criticism that I make of this isn't really going to depend on those details. Okay. Right, so there's the initial question. Well, so why should reduction of classical to quantum mechanics, right, initially, so it's a question you really pose, require the h-bar goes to zero limit to be non-singular, or the h-bar goes to zero and t to infinity limits to commute? So there's that initial question of why this domain subsumption, right, really requires, right, especially given the initially sort of unphysical seeming nature of this limit, right, and right, unless one properly specifies some unit of action, which is typically not done, or some measure of action, right? So why should reduction require the h-bar goes to zero limit to be non-singular, right? And also, why attribute, so this particular correspondence given by Maslow's construction, right? So we notice that these limits don't commute in this particular construction, right? And so there's a question as to why these singularities are problems for reduction per se, rather than for just this particular sort of construction or this particular sort of correspondence, right? Why does this Maslow construction have to be the only way, it's basically assumed that it's the only way of getting, right, reduction of classical to quantum mechanics, right, insofar as its failure is taken to preclude reduction, right? And so there's just a question of, right, why does the failure of this particular construction mean that we should, right, infer the failure of reduction as a whole? Right. And also, right, the physical assumptions of the analysis are unrealistic in the sense that if one really intends to model real classical systems, right, they're not isolated. Right? They interact with some environment. Right? And so and this whole analysis basically presupposes that the system itself is isolated. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about an empirical approach, right? So the approach I just, right, kind of briefly described really focuses just on the mathematical, on a particular mathematical correspondence between quantum and classical theories. Right, now I want to move to a more empirical approach. Okay, and so the claim here is that the kind of picture of classical behavior, right, given by decoherence theory, or at least implied by decoherence theory, really fits within this more empirical framework, right? A framework in which, right, reduction is not only a question of the mathematical relationship between the models, but also has some additional sort of empirical components. Right? And so what I'm going to do is outline a picture of the empirical reduction of quantum to classical to quantum mechanics, right, by offering a certain synthesis of results from, right, Zurek, Paz, Gell-Mann, Hartle, Griffiths, Giuse, Kiefer, Schlosshauer, and Jess as well, that really kind of clarifies how, right, results from decoherence theory can be fit into this more empirical picture of reduction. And so the synthesis really develops in more detail. I think a picture that at least in its broad outlines is understood by many researchers in decoherence theory, but that I don't think has been fully synthesized. But the picture, you know, verbally speaking at least, is outlined by a philosopher of physics named Guido Bacigalupi. Right? And right, first he distinguishes between, right, kinematical and dynamical aspects of classicality. Right? So kinematical aspects of classicality are things like, right, having determinate or roughly determinate values for variables like position and momentum, right, whereas dynamical aspects are really more like approximating mathematical solutions to Newton's equations or to Hamilton's equations. Right? And so the literature on quantum classical relations, right, can also, right, so for example, the literature on quantum measurement theory really concerns more kinematical features. Whereas, say, the literature on Ehrenfest's theorem or WKB or things like that really concern more dynamical features of classicality. Okay. Now, A second claim that he makes is that decoherence is really an interpretation-neutral body of results, right? So decoherence theory offers us a body of results that really are applicable across a wide range of different interpretations of quantum theory, where by interpretation, I mean some essentially collapse mechanism, right? So different interpretations, examples of different interpretations would be, say, right, the Everett theory or the Bohm theory or DRW theory. Right, so all of these are different interpretations. The claim here is that decoherence, right, is in essence an interpretation-neutral body of results. That is, the significance of decoherence-based results, right, are really applicable or can be superimposed across different interpretations with different collapse mechanisms. Okay. Thirdly, he notes that at least some form of Ehrenfest's theorem, although I'm going to dispute the particular form here, right, serves to show that branch relative trajectories, that is, once we've got decoherence that defines a branching structure for us, or we want to look at how systems behave relative to those branches, right? A form of Ehrenfest's theorem, right, he says, will guarantee that the branch relative trajectories are very likely to approximate solutions to classical equations of motion. Okay. And so essentially what interpretation-specific collapse mechanisms do is they essentially, right, take on the branching structure given to us by decoherence, and their job is more or less, right, putting it roughly, to pick a branch in accordance with the Born rule. Right. And really, so what I want to do is really flesh out this picture in more technical detail and show how it conforms to an empirical understanding of reduction. Right, so I'm going to show how the synthesis, right, provides a viable strategy for the empirical reduction of classical to quantum mechanics. Right, and is unaffected by these kind of formally motivated concerns about singular h-bar goes to zero limits. Right, so our approach, unlike some approaches to quantum classical reduction, right, is not to begin with an arbitrary quantum system and say, what is its classical limit? Right, rather, the approach is to say, take any given system, real physical system, like a baseball, that's well modeled by classical mechanics, right, and ask, how do I model the system quantum mechanically, purely quantum mechanically, without any reference to classical concepts? Right. And so the idea here is really that just for every successful application of classical mechanics, we have some underlying quantum description. It's not necessarily the case that for every quantum description, we will have a corresponding classical one. So we don't require it. And so it's important to note, so here, right, so the idea is just pick a given system in the domain of classical mechanics, keep that system fixed, right, and really examine the relationship between the classical model of that system and the quantum model of that very same system, and try to understand what the relationship is between two models of the same system, right, such that the quantum model gives a more precise characterization of those features that are well modeled by the classical model. Right, and h bar, importantly, is kept constant throughout the analysis. Okay, so again, right, take a real physical system that exhibits classical Newtonian behavior, so like a center of mass of the moon or baseball, or, right, also say a charged particle in a bubble chamber or a charged particle in an accelerator, right? We use the Lorentz force law to guide particles in accelerators, right? So those represent another, right? So it's often thought that only macroscopic systems are really in the domain of classical mechanics, right? But in fact, right, subatomic particles, we often use classical equations of motion to describe their trajectories. Okay. So I'll assume, just for simplicity, you know, and we can ask about how to generalize this later, but just that we have a simple Hamiltonian, right, p squared over 2m plus some arbitrary potential v of x. And the question is, right, so given that our system is well, right, the trajectory of the system is well described by Hamilton's equations with this Hamiltonian, right, how do we model that system quantum mechanically? Okay, so the setup will be familiar, right? So, right, we'll have the system of interest, S, whose Newtonian trajectories we wish to recover, and then coupled to some environment, right? And the full dynamics, so we'll assume that the system and environment are closed and they evolve unitarily according to a Schrodinger equation of this form, where this is the system's Hamiltonian, this is the identity for the environment, Hilbert space, this is the identity for the system, Hilbert space, this is the environment Hamiltonian, and this is an interaction Hamiltonian. And I'm further going to assume that the system's reduced dynamics are well described by a Caldeir or Leggett equation with pure decoherence. So I'm assuming that we can neglect dissipation right now, but the analysis generalizes fairly straightforward to cases where you include a dissipation term. Okay. So, right, so to connect this basic framework, right, to properties of real classical systems like a baseball, right, it helps look closely at the branching structure that results from decoherence. So again, so some of this is, a lot of this is going to be familiar, but hopefully I'll get into, pretty soon it will get into the things that I hope at least are somewhat illuminating. So the branching structure of a unitarily evolving quantum state, right, is usefully described or usefully characterized using the decoherent histories framework. Right? And so the decoherence histories framework employs the formalism of PVMs, or positive projection valued measures, and positive operator valued measures. And so just recall, right, so a projection valued measure is just a set of, right, self-adjoint operators on a Hilbert space that sum to the identity and that are mutually orthogonal. Right? And a positive operator valued measure, right, is just a set of positive operators, right, on a Hilbert space that sum to the identity. Okay. Now we can construct a particular POVM, right, using coherent states. Right, so let us take the class. Let's just look, consider the, just as a formal mathematical description, right, the classical phase space of our system S. Right, we can construct a POVM on the corresponding Hilbert space, right, by just basically partitioning the phase space into cells. Right, so these cells mu alpha. Right, so the union of all these cells is just going to be the phase space, and they're mutually disjoint. Okay, now. Right, and assume that, so z here is a coherent state localized about a particular momentum q and a particular momentum p, right? So z is just a shorthand for q and p. Okay. So if we integrate, right, this operator over a particular cell in phase space, right? So, right, we're going to get a particular element of this POVM, right? And these operators will all sum to the identity, so one can show that. And so the z's correspond, right? So they're just, they constitute an overcomplete basis for S's Hilbert space. Okay. Now, if we allow these cells to be large enough, right? So if we assume that the coherent states are minimum uncertainty wave packets, right? So that their phase space volume is roughly h bar, and we assume that these cells are significantly larger than h bar in volume, right, then these operators will constitute an approximate PVM. Okay. So they will be approximately mutually orthogonal. And so, right, so if we just make these cells large enough, right, we can define an approximate coherent state PVM on the total Hilbert space, sorry, on the Hilbert space of S, and then we can extend that just by adding the identity or tensoring with the identity in the environment. Right? And so this set will constitute an approximate PVM on the whole Hilbert space.
That, yeah, approximation is the correction of order H bar.
That's a good question. I'm not sure. No, I'll say. So my claim is here is not that we should do without limits altogether, right, or without expansions in H bar altogether. But I'll get to that in a second. Okay. So given this approximate PVM on the whole Hilbert space, right, we can decompose the unitary evolution of the total system up to some time n delta t, right, just by inserting the identity at these regular intervals of time. All right, so these are all the identity. Right? And then we just take all the sums out to the beginning, right? And we have a sum over basically history operators, right? So operators that are indexed by alpha 0 to alpha n, right, acting on the initial state. So the unitary evolution up to some time n delta t can just be described by a sum over all of these histories, these phase space histories, essentially, acting on the initial quantum state. Okay. Right. So these operators are just defined like this. Right. So these are, they're essentially just a unitary evolution projection, and so on. Okay. Now, the set of phase space histories, right, alpha 0 to alpha n, is called decoherent, right, if these different, right, these different history vectors are mutually orthogonal whenever they differ with respect to any index. Right? So the only way in which they're not orthogonal, right, is if they share all indexes in common. Right? So these branch vectors are called decoherent, right? Right? If they're mutually orthogonal, if they differ with respect to any index. Right? So more formally, right, it's known as medium decoherence. Okay, so decoherence of histories, right, and an approximate coherent state PVM is implied by environmental decoherence. Right? So environmental decoherence, right, basically requires that, so in environmental decoherence, a certain pointer basis of states will become correlated with different environmental states that are mutually orthogonal if they're basically attached to different pointer states. Okay, so one can show, right, that environmental decoherence, right, implies decoherence of histories in this, right, if we adopt, right, this coherent state PVM. Right, and this basically is just a result of the fact that, right, it's a result of the assumption that the pointer states under environmental decoherence are just coherent states. Right. So by assuming that the, right, so basically it just follows, so you can just follow the analysis through. But if you assume that the pointer states under environmental decoherence are coherent states, then that implies that the histories defined using this approximate coherent state PVM are mutually decoherent. Okay. Right. So let's now assume. Right. I'm just going to assume now. Right. But it's something that needs to be proven. Right. That we have environmental decoherence. Right. Or that our model is such that we have environmental decoherence. Right. I want to look at the unitary evolution. Right, of the system under the assumption of environmental decoherence with respect to a coherent state pointer basis. Okay. So we start out with some initial state. But we evolve it up to some decoherence timescale. So it's a very short time, right? And these branches will be mutually orthogonal. But then we evolve it forward some time delta t, right? We add another index, right? So the number of branches increases by essentially one index, right? And right, so these branches will be mutually orthogonal if they differ with respect to any index. But evolve it yet another, right? We add another index. And then these branches are mutually orthogonal if they differ with respect to any index, and so on up to some arbitrary time and delta t, right? And so, right, this is, right, a branching evolution in the sense that right, each branch vector, right, is all the branch vectors are mutually orthogonal, right? And the number of branches increases over time. Okay. Now, there's a formal definition of branching given by Griffiths that I'm not going to get into, but intuitively, at least, right, I hope one can see how this sort of evolution would constitute a branching evolution.
Question?
Yeah.
Does delta t go to zero in this, or is it?
It can go down to the decoherence time scale, essentially.
Okay, it's set by that.
Yeah. Right. Yep. Thanks. Right. So given such a branching evolution, right, to each branch at each time, just formally speaking, right, we can assign a normalized branch state. Right, so we can just normalize the branch vector, and that, right, constitutes a particular effective quantum state. Right, so this W is just the norm of the branch vector. Okay, and so now I'm going to describe a certain ad hoc collapse procedure, right, that looks like the one that you find in ordinary textbooks, except that it's explicitly required to be compatible with decoherence. That is, it's explicitly required as its output to produce one of the branch vectors that are defined through decoherence. Okay, so, right, so if we evolve from the effective state associated with one particular branch at time I delta t, and we evolve it forward by a unit of time delta t, right, what we'll get is a superposition, right, if we just take a unitary evolution, a superposition over states indexed with this additional index alpha I plus 1. Okay. Now, in a completely ad hoc way, right, so I'm just going to prescribe, right, that this superposition now collapses onto one element of this, so onto one of its components, right, with the probability given by the Born rule. Right, and it's straightforward to show, right, that the probability given by the Born rule is essentially just this W alpha, right, up to I plus 1, squared over W alpha up to I squared. So here we're just imposing in a completely ad hoc way a collapse onto one of the branches, right? So we have unitary evolution onto a superposition from one branch onto a superposition of branch states at a later time, and followed by a normal Born rule collapse onto a branch state at a later time. Right? And these branch states are defined by the decoherence condition. Okay, so just combining these two, we just have a stochastic evolution from a branch state at an earlier time, at time I delta t, to a branch state at a time I plus 1 delta t. Right, and so it's just the usual Born rule collapse, except it's required to be decompatible with the branching structure defined through decoherence. Right, and so the justification for this is interpretation dependent, right? So the collapse, the collapse onto a particular branch state, what justifies that process, or what justifies the move from the superposition of branch states into a particular branch state, right? It depends on one's interpretation, right? So for example, right, in GRW theory, right, we have an extra stochastic term in Schrodinger's equation that will select one of the branches, right? So it'll just lop off all the other branches, right? So we have this branching structure, the set of possible GRW evolutions, and at the moment we get a superposition, right? Essentially, the extra term in Schrodinger's equation added by GRW kicks in and just picks out one of these branches. Right? Now there's something, right? So this assumes that the collapse mechanism of GRW is in fact decoherence compatible, right? So it's not immediate, or doesn't follow immediately, that the extra stochastic term that GRW includes in Schrodinger's equation, right, the states that those collapses produce will coincide with decoherence, the branch states associated with decoherence, right? So that's something that needs to be shown. But for the purposes of this analysis, let's just assume that GRW does coincide with the branch states, associated with decoherence. Right? In Bohm's theory, right, again, we have a branching structure, right? So we have a unitary evolution, so it's always unitary in Bohm's theory. Right? And what the effective collapse mechanism of Bohm's theory requires is that different branches be disjoint in the total configuration space. So essentially what will happen, so the manner in which Bohm's theory picks out a particular branch is just because the configuration will come to be guided by only one particular branch at each branching process. And Everett's theory basically says we don't need to add anything, right? That each branch is its own independent reality, right? So each branch is its own quasi-classical sort of determinate reality, right? So in each of these interpretations has a different way of justifying this ad hoc sort of decoherence compatible collapse, right? So let's just bracket the question of interpretation, right? And just assume that somehow, right, this decoherence compatible collapse process is underwritten by whatever happens to be the right way of thinking about measurement. Okay, so then given a branching structure for defined through decoherence, we can associate, right, a branch relative or branch specific stochastic evolution. Right? So we can associate a particular stochastic evolution from branch relative states where at each time, right, the probability of collapse is given by the Born rule. And we can imagine taking the time intervals smaller and smaller, down to the decoherence time. Right? And it's very straightforward to show that the probability of any particular history of branch states, of branch-specific states, right, is just going to be given by the magnitude squared of the branch, of the associated branch vector. Right? So essentially you just multiply all these probabilities together, that's the probability of history, and you just get a bunch of cancellations and you're just left with this. Okay, now associated with any particular branch state, we can define the branch relative reduced state, right, which is just basically you just trace over the environment. So you just take the branch state and trace over the environment. And so that will give you a reduced density matrix associated with just that particular branch, alpha 0 to alpha n. And so if you look at the distributions in position and momentum of this reduced branch relative density matrix, right, the position and distribution will be narrowly peaked on the scale, which is basically the position dimension of that cell, of the associated of the associated cell in phase space, the cell in phase space associated with this index alpha I. Okay? And if you look at the momentum distribution, right, it'll be narrowly peaked on the scale dp, which is basically just the momentum dimension of the cell in phase space associated with this index alpha I. Okay, so relative, right, so these branch relative states are narrowly localized, right, in position and momentum. Right, and so, right, so that's what we mean by, that's what's often meant by quasi-classical, right? So quasi-classical just means essentially a determinate or approximately determinate. And so these branch relative states are approximately determinate in both position and momentum. Right, and so we can assign a stochastic density matrix evolution, right? So we can look at the reduced state of the system, right? And the branching structure defined through decoherence will give us a branch relative evolution of the quasi-classical, like this narrowly localized reduced density matrix. Right, and corresponding to that evolution, we can associate a particular stochastic trajectory in classical phase space. Right, so let's just take the branch relative expectation values of the system's position and momentum. Right, so we just take the expectation value relative to a particular branch state, right, and that stochastic branching evolution, right, defined through decoherence, will induce, right, through the operation of taking these expectation values, so this is just the position of S and the momentum of S, will induce a stochastic trajectory on the associated classical phase space. Right, and so we can just kind of summarize, right? So z alpha 0 to alpha n is just the branch relative expectation value of position and momentum. Right? Right, so z is just this xp operator, so it's just joined. Right, and so right, by given a stochastic evolution of the branch vectors, that induces a stochastic evolution on phase space. Right, and so the way to think about these branch relative expectation values is that they're, if we have the same system, say a baseball, we can have a classical model of that system's evolution. We can also have a quantum model of that system's evolution. The features of the system itself that are well described by classical position and momentum, right, on the quantum model, those same features are described by the branch relative expectation values of position and momentum. Right? So what classical models describe using x and p, quantum models will describe those very same features of the system using these branch relative expectation values. Yeah?
Can you just say what is exactly this branch relative expectation values? What does it mean exactly? Branch relative?
So it's just saying, so to each branch at each time, we can associate a particular branch state, which is just the normalized branch vector. Yes. And then just take the expectation value of position with respect to that state. Right, and take the expectation value of momentum with respect to that state. Right, those values will give you a point in phase space.
Are you not observing the system through this POVM that you said initially?
So I don't want to think about it in terms of observers yet. I'm just thinking about it in terms of, right, really just take the observer out of the equation for a second and just think about the evolution. I just think about the story that you're going to tell about the evolution of the environment and the system together, right? And then ultimately, we'll see how we can find the observer in the wave function, right? But the observer doesn't enter the analysis at the outset. Really, we look at the overall structure of the wave function and then find the observer, right, in the environment, the branch relative environment state, essentially.
So the POVMs are being used to construct the history.
Right. Yeah.
Which I think maybe this question. The when he uses the POVM, it's not being used to say there's a observer implementing this POVM. It's literally just being used to define the histories, which is another way of saying how you're divvying up the wave function into branches. Just a way of doing that.
Yeah. So when you use the POVM or the PVM formalism, it's assumed that you have an observer who's inducing some collapse. I'm not using the formalism in that way. It's really just another way of decomposing the unitary evolution of the wave function. It's the only sense in which it's being used. So that there's no observer assumed here, right? It's just you have, you know, a system and an environment, and you ask, how does that evolve according to the laws of the theory?
But shouldn't you relate it to some observer at the end of the day?
Yeah. And we can talk about that, yeah. But I mean, basically what will happen, where the observer lies, is in, if you look at the branch relative state, and you look at the environmental aspect of that state, the observer will lie in the environmental portion of the branch state. And
so there is effectively, the environment is performing observation, and we're interested in that description of that.
Yeah, but the observation occurs through the process of decoherence. So the observation is essentially just another physical process that occurs because there are correlations established between the environment and the system itself.
And this, the expectation value of P, corresponds to some particular value that is being read by the environment?
Yeah, exactly. Relative to a particular branch, right? So our world, right, the actual, right, any definite state of affairs that we might observe is associated with one particular branch in the overall unitary evolution.
Okay.
And relative to one particular branch, right, the position and momentum are basically determinant, right? They have some tails, and you know, how you want to think about those tails is a question we can talk about. But you know, if you allow yourself to say, okay, position and momentum relative to a branch are more or less determinant, right? Then essentially relative to a particular branch, the evolution is always, right? There's always a determinate position and a determinate momentum within the bounds of precision given by the Turkey principle. Right, so the stochastic kind of effective quasi-classical evolution, right, that we just associate with the branch structure and that will be justified on an interpretation-dependent basis, it gives us an evolution in phase space. Okay? So it gives us an evolution, right, of points in phase space just by taking branch relative expectation values. Right. And as we take the time steps smaller and smaller, we get a better approximation to a continuous trajectory in phase space. Right, so just take delta t down to zero, effectively, although there are questions about what happens when you get to the decoherence timescale. And you've got a stochastic trajectory on phase space that's induced by the branch relative evolution in Hilbert space. All right, and so this quantum phase space trajectory, right, as just defined as the trace over the branch relative reduced density matrix, so it's trace over S of the branch relative reduced density matrix times position and momentum. Right, so empirical reduction, just to get back to the earlier theme of the talk, right, empirical reduction requires that the branch relative quantum trajectory approximate the classical trajectory, the classical phase space trajectory, in all cases where the classical trajectory succeeds at describing the system itself. Right, so there are cases in which classical mechanics doesn't work, right, in which classical trajectories don't accurately, right, track the behavior of a system. Right, and so we only require the quantum trajectory to approximately agree with the classical trajectory in those cases where the classical trajectory actually is successful at describing the system. Right, and so what, right, so if we assume that the classical trajectory, right, characterizes the system's evolution to within some empirically determined margin delta z, right, so that delta z is really just a lower bound on, or sorry, it's an upper bound on the deviation between the actual predicted trajectory and the trajectory of the system itself, and time scale tau c, which is the time scale over which, right, the classical model can be expected to track the system's behavior, right, within this margin, then reduction requires that with very high probability, right, the quantum trajectory and the classical trajectory agree within the margin of error within which the classical model succeeds at describing the system. Okay, so, right, and there's this factor of two here essentially because, right, ZC, right, is required, right, so the classical trajectory is required to track the system within a margin delta Z. Right, if the quantum model does just as well at tracking the system, then at most it can be deviate from the classical trajectory by 2 delta Z. Right, so more precisely, right, if we take some initial density matrix, right, map it up to the phase space, right, that'll be some z0. We can evolve that z0 either according to the classical dynamics, right, or we can ask what is the induced evolution by the stochastic branch relative dynamics. Right. And so, Right, what reduction requires is that these trajectories agree within this empirical margin over the empirically determined timescale where classical models are successful. Right, so a way to picture this, right, just generally, right, if we have some deterministic model describing a system, and then we also have some stochastic model describing a system, right, reduction of the deterministics to the stochastic model essentially requires that there exists a certain mapping from the reducing model to the reduced model, right, or from the stochastic model to the deterministic model, such that, right, with very high likelihood, the induced trajectory, the induced stochastic trajectory, approximate the high-level trajectory or the deterministic trajectory in all cases where the deterministic trajectory itself is, succeeds at describing the system. Yeah.
So I wonder to what extent is it necessary to introduce this environment? I have a feeling that maybe if you just localize well enough in phase space at the beginning for not too long time, even if you make the measurement, so you turn on the environment at some later time, you're going to find it pretty much on that.
Yeah. Can we get to that in the question period? But the environment plays an important role for a number of reasons. I mean, because the expectation values don't behave in the same way in the long run. Yeah. And also, you don't have the branches defined without the environment. But why don't we pick that up in the question period? So there's a picture of reduction here, but it's a bit different from the process of simply taking limits. Right? It really asks to fix your system, or you have two models of the system's behavior, right? How do you ensure that the induced dynamics, right, approximates the dynamics of the high-level model in cases where the high-level model is successful? Right? And so there's a sense in which this approach to reduction, right, is local because it starts out at least by looking at just focusing attention on a single system and looking at two models of the same system. It's empirical because it only requires the low-level model to dovetail with the high-level model in cases where the high-level model succeeds. Right? And it's model-based because really it's focusing on relations between two models of a single system, right, rather than attempting to do this kind of grand wholesale analysis where you take the limit of a whole theory, right, and attempt to recover another theory from it. Okay, so we've seen how to recover stochastic phase space trajectories, right, through the branching structure that we get from decoherence and through this ad hoc prescription that will be justified on an interpretation dependent basis. But why should we expect Newtonian trajectories? Or why should these branch relative trajectories be Newtonian? Okay. Now, right, if we assume that the system's total density matrix, right, so it's important to distinguish between the system's total density matrix and its branch relative density matrix. Right. If we assume that the total reduced density matrix, right, obeys the Caldieri-Leggett equation, right, then Yaos and Zay, right, have shown that you basically get the Ehrenfest relationship. Right? So you get this and this, right? But this is for an open system. So this differs from the ordinary Ehrenfest theorem, which assumes that the system is closed. But here we're assuming the system's open. And at least for certain open systems that are described by the Caldieri-Leggett equation that I showed before, but you get the same Ehrenfest theorem. Okay, but now we can take this result further than Yaos and Zay do, right? By considering what happens when we restrict the total reduced density matrix of S to be a narrow wave packet, but narrow in ensemble width. Right, so if we just restrict our attention for the moment, and then we'll justify this later, a restricted density matrix whose position space ensemble width is narrow by comparison with V, then what we get is that the expectation values, the total expectation values of position and momentum follow an approximately Newtonian trajectory. Right, so the expectation values of position and momentum follow Newton's equations approximately. Right, but this is the evolution of the total expectation value as opposed to the branch relative expectation value. Right, but if the total initial reduced state of S is a state of narrow ensemble width and position, but then what that implies is that the branch relative trajectories will be close to the expectation values, right? Because essentially the ensemble width in position and momentum characterizes the average deviation of branch relative trajectories from the total expectation value. Right? And so, right, we can expect that if, right, the state is initially narrow in ensemble width, the total state, then the branch relative reduced states will be approximately Newtonian, right, over timescales where the ensemble width, the total ensemble width, remains narrow by comparison with the dimensions of V. Okay. Right, so slow, what we really need, right, so basically we'll get approximately Newtonian behavior on timescales where the ensemble spreading of the total in position of the total reduced density matrix, right, is slow. Right. So on a timescale where the ensemble width spreads to the dimensions of the potential or beyond the dimension, the margin of approximation that you regard as acceptable for classicality, on that timescale, we'll have branch relative trajectories will be extremely likely to be approximately Newtonian because they'll be extremely likely to be close to the Newtonian expectation value. Right. So how to see this a bit more in a bit more technical detail. Right. So if we have a branch, let us take the total, right, the total pure state of the system, including all branches. Right. Take that density matrix of the system plus environment, trace over the environment. Right. Essentially, what we get, because these branches are orthogonal with respect to the environment, is that the total reduced density matrix of S is a weighted sum of branch relative reduced density matrices, right, where the weighting is given by the magnitude squared of the associated branch vector. Okay. And if we look at the position distribution, right, so if we just sandwich with x eigenstates on this, right, what we find is that the total position distribution, right, is just a weighted sum over different branches, right, of these branch relative distributions, which are all narrow wave packets, which are all narrowly peaked and quasi-classical. Okay, now the idea here is that since the total reduced density matrix remains narrow, so if we assume that the total reduced density matrix is narrow, right, and the ensemble spreading is slow, right, since the total ensemble packet remains concentrated around the Newtonian trajectory, right, it's basically required that each of these individual branch packets will also be concentrated around the Newtonian trajectory, right? Because they can't cancel each other out, right? Essentially, right, the only, you know, if this is narrowly peaked around the Newtonian trajectory, then the only ones of these that can contribute, right, for which this can be non-zero, are ones that are narrowly focused around the Newtonian trajectory, right? So the idea, right, is that we start out, right, so this is on a classical phase space. Right, we assume that we have an initially narrow ensemble wave packet, right, and that maps to some point the expectation value of position and momentum. Right, and then, right, as we evolve that forward, right, the branching structure will give rise to different branch relative phase space trajectories. Right, and as the ensemble packet spreads, you'll get the spanning out of different trajectories in phase space. The branch relative evolution, right, or the stochastic evolution, right, will pick out one of these branch relative trajectories. Now, if the spanning width, right, is narrow enough, it's extremely, so any of these trajectories will be close enough to the Newtonian trajectory. So really what the crucial thing is the rate at which the ensemble width in the system increases. Right, but this analysis assumes, right, that we have an initially narrow wave packet, right, an initially narrow ensemble wave packet, right, but generally speaking, right, Schrodinger's equation, right, or quantum mechanics allows for arbitrary macroscopic superpositions, right, so a generic initial state can be a coherent superposition over macroscopically different positions and momenta, right, but the point here is that decoherence, right, will rapidly carry any such state over the very small timescale associated with decoherence into an incoherent superposition of narrowly peaked quasi-classical states. Right. And so decoherence combined with the effective collapse recipe, right, so this decoherence compatible collapse, will choose one of these quasi-classical states, which is localized around some initial phase space point. Right, and then we can just apply the preceding analysis. Right. So the picture to have is that if we have some initially macroscopic superposition, right, over many different positions and momenta, right, decoherence combined with our branch with decoherence compatible collapse will pick out one of these in a completely probabilistic manner. Right. From there on, the effective state of the system is narrowly peaked, and we get this fanning out, right? And the branch relative trajectory is very likely to be approximately Newtonian on the scale or on the time scales where the spanning is not too big. Okay, so basically on the time scale t where ensemble width, right, of an initial pointer state remains below, right, the empirically determined threshold or the margin of error for classicality, right, branch relative trajectories will approximate, right, basically on the time scale t where ensemble spreading, right, remains below, right, a certain empirically determined margin of error, right, delta z, the branch relative trajectories will very likely be Newtonian. So reduction requires, right, that this time scale, big T, essentially time scale associated with ensemble spreading, be much larger than the time scale on which classical models are known to work. Right? So basically we need, right, the time scale for ensemble spreading to be bigger or at least as big as the time scale where classical models describe the behavior of the system. Right? And that ensures that with very high likelihood, quantum trajectories track the system's behavior in all cases where quantum trajectories do. Now, factors affecting the rate of spreading include the mass of the system, right, size of the Lyapunov exponent associated with the system's Hamiltonian, and decoherence, which actually, decoherence reduces the coherence width, but actually it contributes to ensemble spreading. Okay. And so these factors have to combine to make the time scale associated with ensemble spreading greater than or equal to the time scale on which classical models, right, track the system's behavior. Right. If this isn't the case, right, so if it's not the case that big T is greater than tau sub c, right, then there's classical behavior that can't be modeled quantum mechanically and we don't have reduction. Right, so I'm almost done here. So if we assume just for the moment that the time scale associated with ensemble spreading is bigger than this empirically determined margin, but then the quantum trajectory essentially takes the form of a classical trajectory, but with small branch relative fluctuations, right? So essentially the quantum trajectory at some time delta t is just the classical trajectory plus some fluctuations or deviations from classicality that depend on the branch, so they're indexed by the branch, right? And what we require is just the size of these fluctuations be small by comparison with the margin within which classical models are known to track the system's behavior. Right, so take an alpha particle. Right, so an alpha particle in a background magnetic field. Right, its trajectory is described roughly by Newtonian trajectory. Well, but with some dissipation. Right, and so the idea is that our branch relative, right, dynamics or our stochastic dynamics, right. So the effective state of the system. We'll pick out a branch at each moment in time, and that will induce a corresponding phase space trajectory. That phase space trajectory has to agree with the Newtonian trajectory within the empirically determined margins. So, right, so the light dot on the top is the Newtonian trajectory, and the dark one is the behavior of the alpha particle. Right, and you can think about a baseball in exactly the same way. Right, so. Right, so what's different, right, so there's a system dependence here in the sense that the parameters, right, the time scales over which Newtonian models are, sorry, where the time scale over which the classical and quantum models are required to agree in the alpha particle case are going to be less than the time scales over which they're required to agree in the baseball case. And likewise, right, for margins of error. So there's a certain system dependence as far as, right, how precisely and over what time scales the dovetailing is required to occur for reduction to take place. Right. Now, right, what I've given you here is essentially an outline. Right? So there are lots of gaps in this sort of story. Right? So there's a question about how to reconcile. Right? So decoherence is a process that proceeds, where branching is a process that goes from past to future. Right? But the Schrodinger equation, fundamentally, right, that's supposed to underlie decoherence, right, from which decoherence is supposedly derived, is time reversible. And so there's a question about how to resolve or reconcile, rather, the time irreversibility of decoherence with the time reversibility of Schrodinger's equation. Right? I also assumed a natural division between the system of interest and the environment. Right? But there's, right, a question about how to justify that from a perspective where everything, you know, if you start off with a completely microscopic description where you just have n particles, or what justifies the kind of choice of a certain subset of those for agglomeration into the system that you're interested in. All right, there's the set selection problem, right, which Jess has done a lot of work on. Right, and essentially, right, this is a question of how you define the branching structure. Right, so there are mutually different, there are incompatible distinct sets of decoherent histories which define different branching structures for the wave function. So how do you, do you need to pick out a unique one, and if so, how? And we also, right, there's also a question about how to prove that the time scale for ensemble spreading is in fact greater than or equal to the time scale where Newtonian trajectories furnish good approximations to the system's behavior. Right, so I'm just going to go here. So what I've said so far can seem quite critical of the limit-based approach, but that's not to suggest, right, that limits don't have any role. Right. So, right. Often, to get decoherence on rapid enough timescales, you need lots of degrees of freedom in the environment, right? So there's a sense in which you're taking the limit as the number of degrees of freedom goes to infinity. But as you take mass gets larger, right, the rate of ensemble spreading slows, right? So as mass gets larger, the timescale over which, right, the branch relative quantum trajectories are approximately Newtonian also goes to infinity. Right, you require the POVM partition cells to have phase space volume much larger than h bar over n. Right? But the important lesson here is not that limits aren't important, but rather that at least initially in the analysis, you want to keep the system fixed. Right? Perform the analysis for a fixed system and then ask, once you've done that, right, how, say, the reduction timescales or the margins of error, right, change, right, when you vary things like the mass and so on. Right? So finally, just to wrap up, right, so if by reduction we simply mean, right, so if by theory A reduces to theory B, we simply mean that theory B, right, can model all behaviors that are successfully modeled by theory A, right, then an empirical approach to reduction is far more appropriate than a formal approach, right, because there are certain empirical inputs, right, the measure of the dovetailing, right, that's required for a reduction. Right, depends on certain empirical facts. Right. Now, questions about empirical reduction, right? So it's not to suggest that reduction isn't a highly mathematical enterprise, right? But rather that it's really a certain empirically constrained mathematical relationship, right, that underlies reduction. Right. So, and then finally, right, so it's often so it's sometimes said that, you know, certain singularities as h bar goes to zero block reduction of classical to quantum mechanics. But it seems quite clear here that those results don't have any bearing, right, on the sort of decoherence-based analysis that I've given. Right, so the worry about, you know, the double slit experiment about, you know, taking h bar goes to zero and it just oscillates infinitely rapidly, it's not clear how that sort of singularity blocks any of the sort of story that I've told here. In decoherence theory, right, so it furnishes a viable strategy for empirical reduction of classical to quantum mechanics. Thanks.
I was unclear about the relationship between the particular decoherence model you assume, the Caldera, Leggett, and the choice of the pointer basis. Were you basically saying that, regardless of decoherence model, you assume, like, set that aside, you know, define the notion of branch relative states in this way, and now here's a criterion for determining whether your decoherence model induces a reduction of the quantum dynamics to classical dynamics? Or was your choice of that pointer basis?
Wait, sorry, is it the first thing again?
I'm just wondering if I should think of you're offering a sort of generic criterion for when a quantum dynamics reduces to a classical mechanics, which you could then go and test for various decoherence models, like the Caldera-Leggett one. Or rather, were you trying to make an argument that, you know, if your decoherence is Caldera-Leggett, then here's a sense in which we can, recover classicality.
Right. So I guess the basic criterion of classicality was really that the induced quantum branch relative quantum trajectory approximate the classical trajectory. Now, if you can do that with models other than the Caldera or Leggett model, right, then that I would still call that reduction. But what I'm saying is here's one widely applicable model, right, of decoherence, right, and that helps to satisfy that criterion. I'm not suggesting that it's the only one that satisfies that criterion.
Did the details of the model factor into your criterion at all? Is your criterion totally independent of that choice of model?
I mean, the criterion really only depends that there exists some branching structure, right, and then you can define that that's such that relative to each branch you have quasi-classical trajectories, right? And just wanting those to approximate the classical trajectories. I think that's really all it was. Now my analysis just showed that in this particular case of the Caldeir-Leggett model, you can get that. I don't know if that.
Can you go to the slide where you show the Caldeir model yields your notion of classicality?
Well, so the idea is that the Caldeir-Leggett model is associated with the choice of a particular pointer basis, right? So Zurek, for example, right? So the progression here is really that you have coherent state pointer basis. So I'm also assuming that, and you can derive a coherent state pointer basis from the Caldeir-Leggett model.
So the coherent state basis showed up as just, you know, a particular choice you're making for, you know, defining histories.
Yeah.
But you're making use of the fact that relative to the Caldeir-Leggett model, this is going to be the most predictable basis. Is that like what you're appealing to that result?
Well, environmentally. So I also made the assumption that coherent states were pointer states under environmental decoherence. So it's not just
pointer states. I mean, they're not an orthogonal basis. So do you just mean they're the most predictable relative?
Yeah, they're the most predictable. Essentially, they remain as product states with the environment. They may remain close. Right. So when you start off a system in a coherent state, you know, in a product state, it stays as a, you know, resists entanglement for the longest period of time.
Okay, and then my other question was the length scales and time scales you talked about in defining your notion of classicality. You kind of describe them as the time scales and length scales on which classical models are known to work, but I wasn't really clear on what you meant by that. Are they, what exactly are they? How do you choose those length scales?
Like, yeah, I mean, so they're really bounds more than precisely determined values. I mean, right, we expect that if you wait long enough, right, if you can track a system, right, with a Newtonian model, right, that there will be a deviation, right, between the Newtonian model and the system itself. Now, part of that can be attributed to chaotic effects, right? But part of it's, you know, kind of error in the initial conditions, but there's also part of it that can be attributed to the model error. To the choice of model altogether. Now, right, we don't have. I'm not saying that we have clearly kind of a clear concept of what those the time scales associated with that model error are, but we think that they exist.
So you're saying you can start with just a classical distribution over initial classical conditions, like at points in phase space, figure out, for example, under chaotic dynamics, how much you expect that to spread, and then ask whether your quantum predictions deviate from your classical predictions within that amount of spread? Is that, am I thinking of this right?
I think it's more subtle than that, in the sense that, so there's an error in, right, so just there's a purely classical error in the spread, just determined by your uncertainty in the initial conditions. That little blob will spread out. There's a different sort of error, right, that's associated with just the dynamical laws that you've chosen for that model, right? And it's difficult to tease those two apart. Error associated
in the parameters of the Hamiltonian, that kind
Sorry?
Of thing? Do you mean uncertainty in the shape of your
In the parameters of the Hamiltonian, or in the form of the Hamiltonian, yeah.
But if I take both those factors into account, that's what defines reduction to classicality, like you want your quantum predictions to be within error of your classical predictions, where the amount of error is determined by those initial uncertainties in the parameters of your Hamiltonian and in the location and phase space of the initial condition? Is that, the idea?
There's a certain idealization that's going on here where you don't assume an initial uncertainty in the initial conditions, where you assume that there's some matter of fact about what the position, some definite, kind of not uncertain matter of fact about what the position and momentum of the system actually is. And there's some classical position and momentum associated with that system that's exact, right? So without that kind of initial error. And you know, our ability to know that is another question. But there's a question about how that exact point in phase space tracks the behavior of the system, right? Removing our sort of epistemic uncertainty. So it's really kind of a question about, you know, what the correspondence is between, you know, the exact dynamics of the classical model, right? Just kind of filtering out that uncertainty in the initial conditions and the actual behavior of the system itself.
That way of describing it makes it seem like your delta Z is something that I can choose arbitrarily. Like I might say, you know, I want reduction that has, you know, 1% error only.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Matt might say, no, I demand 0.1% error, and these are just different notions of reduction. Is that a better characterization?
Yeah, I mean, so there is an arbitrary level of arbitrariness. I mean, there's a bound. So delta Z is really a bound on the error that you're allowing. Right.
It's up to me what error I allow.
It's not completely up to you. So, for example, you couldn't say that you knew delta Z was within, you know, one, small, like, you know, a micron or something like that, or even smaller, right? There's a certain smallness of delta Z that's not plausible, right? There's a certain lower bound on what you can take delta Z to be. Because we just don't know. I mean,
still expect to have some things meet the criterion. That's the idea.
Yeah.
You make it too stringent and nothing will be deemed possible.
Right.
So why did you say micron? Shouldn't it have to do with things like H bar and the typical action scales in the problem?
The delta Z really just characterizes, forgets about the quantum model, right? And just really characterizes the bounds within which, you know, the classical model tracks the behavior of the system itself, and is, you know, is known to track the behavior of the system itself. So there is no relation to the quantum model in that sense, right? So delta Z is something that's determined, or is just a fact about the fit between the classical model and the system itself. Right, rather than anything to do with the quantum model. Right, so it just gives us the bounds within which we should expect the quantum trajectory and the classical trajectory to agree. Right, but the reason we impose that as a bound within which we should expect the quantum and classical trajectory to agree is that we want the quantum trajectory to work at describing the system at least as well as the classical trajectory does. Right, so delta Z, right, is defined irrespective of the quantum model.
All right. Well, I'm back to being confused, but I'm going to talk about it later.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, Clank suggested in this that you're, even for your classical system, you're defining a system with an environment, and so that parameter may depend on the scale of your system relative to its environment. So if you're talking about an alpha particle or an electron, your environment is going to be much more significant. The amount of entropy that's contained within the system itself is going to be very small.
Right.
Whereas if you've got a baseball or a planet, clearly there's a much more substantial classical system that you're talking about. And so the enormous amount of entropy in there is going to make its classical behavior give it a smaller delta Z.
That's possible. I'd have to think about it. I don't know. So you said just the large amount of entropy in the baseball is going to make delta Z smaller.
Yes.
I'm not sure. I mean,
in its interaction with its environment, it's the disruption of the environment is going to be much less than the disruption of a very small classical system with its environment.
Is that because of the entropy or just its inertia?
Well, it's both. I mean, entropy is really just, you know, saying there's an awful lot going on here. And we're coarse graining over all of that structure.
Yeah. I honestly don't know. I'd have to think about it. Maybe, you know, another example might help. So take like Newtonian mechanics, right? We know that there's, so it's just as far as character, with the kind of honing what I mean by this delta z, right? And consider the relationship between Newtonian mechanics and special relativity. All right, there's a certain delta z that characterizes the deviation. So if you try to use Newtonian mechanics to describe, to predict the trajectory of a relativistic particle, right, there will be a delta z between, you know, there will be a deviation between the Newtonian trajectory and the actual behavior of the system itself. And so that's what I really mean by this delta z, that there's a matter of fact about the degree to which, or the margins of error within which, right, the Newtonian model actually succeeds at describing this relativistic
particle. Both of those are classical. We're really talking there that if you've got a relativistic particle, we know that our Newtonian model is not an appropriate model for a relativistic.
Oh yeah, yeah, sure. But the idea is just that you still have a reduction in that case, right? You have a reduction of the Newtonian. I mean, I'm inverting the usual.
Okay.
So the idea is really just delta z is supposed to capture how well your reduced model describes the system itself. And that's an idea that I think can be generalized beyond the sort of Newtonian mechanics special relativity case, right? That it's really a sort of parameter that can be used to characterize reductions more generally. It's a parameter that characterizes really the agreement between your purportedly reduced model and the system itself, and that within which you would want the reducing model to agree with it. Now, I agree that there are a lot of subtleties, you know, with chaos, as far as how you really quantify delta z, I do have to think more about it. But I think that this concept of really an agreement between, you know, the extent of agreement between the reduced model, right, and the system itself, right, there is a measure of accuracy that characterizes how well the reduced model, right, actually describes the system itself. And that's an idea that can be generalized beyond this kind of simple case of Newtonian mechanics and special relativity. Now, you know, questions of chaos, you know, I think do make the interpretation of that delta z and the quantification of that more subtle. But you know, I'm not sure that really undermines the basic idea of trying to quantify the fit between a classical model and the system itself. But I agree that, I mean, you know, it's something that needs more thought. Thanks.
This is again about the environment. I'm not sure. So can you explain, do we really need this environment trapped in the middle? Do we really need an environment? Can we not just say that we localize the states in phase space, more or less?
Well, we need the branches, yeah. Because
isolated system, I believe. It's not going to differ too much.
Yeah.
So I can say something to that. When I learned this, I thought it was very surprising and super important, and it's not trivial, is that if you basically imagine, choosing a, so if you have a classical chaotic system, and you choose a kind of smaller and smaller patch of phase space, and you call the area of that H bar, it's kind of your initial minimum uncertainty, then it gets stretched exponentially on a time scale given by the Lyapunov constant. And so what that means is that if you say, I don't want it to be stretched macroscopically, then the time scale over which that can possibly hold only depends logarithmically on H bar. So in principle, you can kind of make the system, you know, keep the uncertainty at a microscopic scale arbitrarily long. But in fact, the you have to take H bar like exponentially towards zero, not just.
Okay, how does it scale here?
It's just a property of having a Lyapunov exponent. Basically, any chaotic degrees of freedom will do this. So the classic example from Zurich and what's the Hyperion example? Zurich and
Ballantyne. Well, I had a debate with Ballantyne.
Yeah, Zurich had a collaborator. Maybe
Paz.
Yeah. Is that if you took a like one of these moons of Hyperion, which is this moon of Saturn, I think, and gave it an h-bar sized uncertainty, then over 20 years it'll become totally quantum mechanical if it was isolated from any kind of an environment. That even though it's super, super duper small, the initial uncertainty, the chaotic dynamics will spread it out to macroscopic degree.
Yeah, so it won't be quasi-classical, yeah. So it won't be narrowly localized in position or momentum. So you'll have basically a Schrodinger cat type scenario.
My intuition is that whenever you make this kind of frequent measurements or whenever you have this environment, it's you only quadratically improve because it's really exploiting some sort of signal. I mean, maybe I'm totally wrong about that, but it's my intuition about how these things scale. But maybe I'm wrong. It's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think the idea is just to get rid of the observer altogether, too, and to get rid of the idea of measurement, you know, periodic measurements.
You see, because in principle, okay, at least classically, we have this idea that I can throw a ball in empty space and go look at it, and if I shine a light later, I should find it more or less following the right trajectory. But if it's following the right trajectory, then we would like, I mean, this is classical mechanics, so we would like to reproduce that here. But you introduce some environment, some heat, and I wonder if it can be done with a closed system.
So just the kind of worries that Jess was raising, really, you know, about the fact chaotic spreading and macroscopic superpositions make that difficult,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks very much.